Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news. Stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, it's the Weekly Worldview. So glad to have you along. Another week here on the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. We come to you on a particularly gloomy night here in Denver. The clouds rolled in today. It was almost enough to make one superstitious, although I'm not one of those. All my personal notes that I took all week were on Tim Tebow, and I don't think I'm going to comment on Tim Tebow during the show today. I think I'm going to save that for local Denver radio tomorrow, when I'll be on KLT, the mighty 50,000 watt blowtorch of the Rocky Mountain West. Either tomorrow, Tuesday, something like that. I will be on local radio, so I think I'm going to save most of that. But I do want to thank Tim. For giving us the opportunity last night, giving me the opportunity to sit with my 10-year-old daughter, Nicole, who was in tears. She was in tears and almost inconsolable, but had an opportunity to have a great conversation with her about losing with grace and dignity and focusing on the reality that there are a lot of things that are bigger than the game. And one of those things was just the fact that I got to sit with my family last night, yesterday evening, and watch the Denver Broncos as they were trodden underfoot by the Tom Brady juggernaut that no doubt will win the Super Bowl, especially now that Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers are out of it. Yeah. So I want to thank Tim for that because... having an opportunity to watch his press conference after the show, after the game, just helped me to have that conversation with my daughter from a biblical, scriptural, spiritual perspective. And so, you know, Tebow's just one of those fellas that win, lose, or draw. Good things happen all around him. I'm excited to have him in Denver, excited to look forward to next season, and just really happy that a game I didn't care about 5 months ago now has become an instrument by which we can all glorify God. And so thanks, Tim, for that. Now, I do want to announce one thing about Mr. Tebow, another accomplishment that he's achieved. Checked in on Twitter today, and just want you folks to know that Tim Tebow this week has gone over 1 million followers on Twitter. We've got the cover of what paper is that? That's the Denver Post. And it's Tim Tebow in the clutches of 8 or 9 Patriots. How many Patriots have him there? 1, 2, 3. Well, there's 4 in the frame. That's a particularly ugly picture. But let's get back to Twitter. Tim Tebow, over 1 million followers this week, while Bill Maher languishes at his same pathetic level that he was at weeks ago. Who cares? Anyway, want to congratulate Tim on... Well, it could be a new record, the fastest Twitter eclipse of an adversarial celebrity. Thank you, Tim, for that. We do appreciate that. And just, I happened to be on Twitter, and so I checked in on Tim Tebow's Twitter feed. And here's Tim's Twitter feed yesterday night was just a few letters and a few numbers. Said Romans 8, 38, and 39. So warning, 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 Will Robinson, there are Bible verses up ahead. For those in the audience who advocate pluralism and diversity, we know here at the Weekly Worldview that you would like to censor anyone who would ever dare even consider possibly quoting a Bible verse in public. So this warning gives you fair notice that raw, unadulterated truth is about to be uttered from the book of Romans in the 8th chapter. The author says, "For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus, our Lord." That was special delivery from Tim Tebow via Twitter today, and that's a good perspective today. For all of us, regardless of whether you're a Broncos fan or a Tim Tebow hater, or you know one of the beautiful, glittery people who absolutely can't stand him, we love him here in Denver, and we hope we keep him. But I think there should be a competition. Anyway, I'll talk more about that on Denver Local Radio. You'll want to tune into that. Maybe I'll post a link here at the Weekly Worldview website. All right. Now, we're going to get on to the news. We're going to put all this huge stack of Tebow commentary over here to the side. And we're going to move on to the news of the week, ladies and gentlemen. This is from the Fun with Magnets file. We've actually got a couple of stories from the Fun with Magnets file this week, which is, that's a record for a new file debut on the Weekly Worldview. Two stories coming out of that file this week. First, from the Fun with Magnets file, this is from the New York Daily News. A Brooklyn doctor is warning parents to be on the lookout for magnetic tongue rings. I said magnetic tongue rings after a 13-year-old boy who swallowed one was rushed to the hospital. Apparently these, well, the article calls them tongue ornaments, which that in and of itself is fairly disturbing. Tongue ornaments are meant to mimic real piercings and use small but powerful magnets to stay connected to the tongue. Now, if swallowed, they can tear holes in organs or intestines as the magnetic force pulls them together.
Ouch.
Yeah, and they can cause blood poisoning, and they could even be fatal. That's according to a pediatrician there in New York City. Now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, issued a warning back in 2006, warning that the faux tongue rings should be avoided because of the medical risks. Yes. I would add that you might want to avoid them because they make other people think you look really stupid. And that's whether it's the actual piercing or the Fun with Magnets version that debuts here on the Weekly Worldview.
So are they encouraging people to actually pierce?
Maybe the Centers for Disease Control prefers that you actually pierce your tongue. That's probably what most of the low-level staffers there do. They go for the real thing. Not up for the Fun with Magnets. Now, we will have one other story in the Fun with Magnets file coming up in just a little bit, but I want to start out with a story that is quite serendipitous, and well, it's another one of these stories that could make you almost become superstitious. It's from Sky News over in London. The captain and first officer of a cruise liner that ran aground off the coast of Italy are being held on suspicion of multiple manslaughter and abandoning ship charges while passengers were still in danger. You've seen the picture, I'm sure, on the internet of this luxury liner laying on its side there off the coast of Italy. It's quite a disturbing and a horrible story. Three people, according to Sky News, are known to have died, and around 40 others are still unaccounted for after the ship apparently hit a rock on Friday the 13th, the same day that Standard & Poor's downgraded most European debt, including Italy's. Really just a microcosm of the global financial crisis, if one chooses to look at it that way, and that's the way we choose to look at the story here on the Weekly Worldview. The ship of state, the ships of state across the globe are in rocky financial waters. And in danger of capsizing. Well, I mean, what more can you say? It's just ironic, serendipitous, an omen. I mean, if you were into that kind of thing, you might say that. But just seeing that picture up on the Drudge Report for the past few days has made me, it's just made me put into perspective how acute the crisis is. Not only for seafarers around the world, but for just about anyone who has stocks, bonds, or a bank account. All right. A real tragedy, though. We're sorry for the loss of life and for the injury. And we pray for the survivors, and we hope that justice is done if this captain indeed was negligent in any way. We hope that justice is done, if that's possible, in the modern day. Ew! The EU. Ew! Anyway, all right, speaking of justice, let's move into the justice file. This is from Jackson, Mississippi, Fox News. A Mississippi judge is blocking the release of 21 inmates given pardons by former Governor Haley Barbour. Have you heard about this? Haley Barbour, obviously in a drunken stupor on his last day in office, pardoned some 200 people, most of whom had already been released from prison, but he expunged their records. And, well, let's see. According to the Fox News article, so far, five of the pardoned prisoners have been released. These are the murderers. Four of whom are convicted murderers. All worked in the governor's mansion while Haley Barbour was doddering around in office. Now let's see. The murderers are David Gatlin, convicted of killing his estranged wife in 1993. Joseph Osment, convicted in 94 of killing a man during a robbery. Anthony McRae, convicted in 01 of killing his wife. Charles Hooker, sentenced to life in 92 for murder. And Nathan Kern, sentenced to life in 82 for burglary on the three strikes rule after two prior. Well, that's the only one I could possibly consider letting out if he was just a burglar. But you got to wonder where Haley Barbour's head is. According to Fox News, a former Republican National Committee chairman, Haley Barbour, was widely hailed for his shepherding the state through several disasters, including Katrina and the BP oil spill. Barbour had been named as a potential presidential candidate last year, just in case you were wondering how far down the drain the Republican Party has indeed swirled. They were actually considering this fat, drunken moron as a presidential candidate last year. But he announced last April that he didn't have the fire in the belly for the presidential bid. The 64-year-old is now on a paid speaker's circuit and is also working for a Jackson-area law firm, and he's also working for a Washington lobbying firm that he founded. He's just a used-up old drunk who's so utterly compromised by his career in American politics. It's shameful and embarrassing, Mr. Barbour. You should go crawl under a rock and just stay in the dark for as long as possible. By the way, I hold Haley Barbour personally responsible for sinking the personhood vote in the final weekend leading up to the vote on personhood in Mississippi. He expressed his concerns because he was too drunk and stupid to understand the amendment, I think. I mean, that's my personal opinion. But I hold him personally responsible. And for this crime, for releasing convicted murderers, God will hold him responsible. So, Haley, just a note from the producers here at the Weekly Worldview. God is watching you, Haley. Just embarrassing. I tell you what, Republicans are about enough to make you want to gag. Just enough to trigger the gag response. Embarrassing. Speaking of the gag response, Mitt Romney is in the news. He's on a roll. I got an email from a friend this morning. No, last night, the most vicious email I've ever received in my life. Because I had just left my living room and the Broncos debacle. And just let me just say I wasn't exactly in a good mood, okay? I open up my inbox. Here's an email from a friend of mine, an article guaranteeing Romney the nomination. And, I emailed him back and I said, you know, after the Broncos loss, I'm willing to believe that anything bad that can happen probably will. But there is hope because it is still early. Romney only has 100 or so delegates. And so I suppose it's still possible to derail him. And that brings me to this WorldNet Daily article. Massachusetts political analyst and Republican State Committee member James Rappaport says that Romney's pro-life conversion is bogus. He says, quote, Romney's major problem is that he doesn't really have an opinion, unquote. And that would be on the legalized murder of innocent children. He says Romney started out as pro-choice in 1994 during the primary. He ran for governor there in Massachusetts. Another political analyst says that Romney's position on the life issue is based on what office he's seeking and where that office is located. They say he decided to run on a pro-choice platform in Massachusetts in 94. Because his pollsters convinced him that pro-life candidate just couldn't win in Massachusetts. You've got to be pro-choice, Mitt. And so Mitt wanted to be the governor, so he was pro-choice. Of course, he had been pro-choice for his entire political career. This political analyst goes on to say, quote, for 30 years, Mitt Romney was a strong advocate of abortion. His wife, Ann, contributed money to Planned Parenthood in 94 at a Planned Parenthood event that both she and her hapless husband attended. And she was filmed during the but then she was filmed during the 2008 campaign claiming, quote, I've always been pro-life, unquote. That's Mitt Romney's wife. Let's assume that they get along, okay, on major issues. This analyst goes on to say, like her husband, Mrs. Romney has engaged in deception in regards to abortion. By 04, 05, Romney had already figured out his chances of re-election in Massachusetts were nil, so he began to set his sights on the White House and the Republican nomination, and hence, of course, he had the Shazam moment where he realized that he was actually pro-choice. And this is an article from WorldNet Daily, and it's I'm very encouraged to finally see conservative news outlets and other potential presidential nominees in the race are finally criticizing Romney for his liberalism instead of for his capitalism. That's Chris Cornell. Thank you very much, Chris. Exit stage left. All right. Now, speaking of Mitt Romney, I've got more bad news. Well, I guess it's bad news. Anyway, this is just a weird story. I took this down off the political ticker via Drudge Report, of course. A Romney campaign volunteer, one Ruth Williams, met Willard Mitt Romney earlier in the week, in the week leading up to the this past week, I should say, and she told him she was having trouble making ends meet. Well, this Saturday past, Romney recognized Ruth Williams, his campaign volunteer there in South Carolina, while he was shaking hands with supporters after a rally, and Romney handed her a handful of money, a fistful of cash. He handed to this this hapless campaign volunteer. Williams told reporters that on Wednesday last week, she had seen Romney's campaign bus on the highway and followed it to an airport. She says, quote, I don't know if I can do this. She says, quote, I was on the highway praying, and I said, God, tell me how to keep my lights on. And there was Mitt Romney's bus right there. So I followed it. Unquote. She said South Carolina State Treasurer and Romney supporter Chris Loftus had given her money the previous week that she had used to pay her light bill. So Mitt Romney and his, I want to use a family-friendly term here. Well, I guess I'll just say his supporters helped this woman pay her light bill. They were an answer to prayer for this. Now, Williams, according to the political ticker, has been volunteering since the original meeting when they handed her some cash. And she said, quote, God didn't tell me to go to nobody else. He told me to pray for Mitt Romney, unquote. Now, the cash gift, according to the ticker, is notable from a candidate who has said he would not give away free stuff as president, but rather would focus on cutting back on federal spending and stimulating private sector growth. Yeah, as he's handing out handfuls of money. This is just emblematic of the Romney campaign, ladies and gentlemen. The only reason he's the front runner is that he's been handing out copious amounts of cash to everyone within arm's length, especially pro-family and pro-life groups whom he has sought to corrupt and co-opt for his own nefarious purposes. Well, the mask is off Mitt Romney, and hopefully this week, ladies and gentlemen, because I don't think it's too late to stop Mitt, okay? I know a lot of many of my well-respected conservative brethren have thrown in the towel and have said Mitt Romney is going to be the nominee, but it's not too late, ladies and gentlemen. We've just got to attack his liberalism, and there's plenty to attack there. Mr. Gingrich, please. What an embarrassment that guy is. What a just unbelievable. I mean, he sounds like he stumbled in from an Occupy DC rally and cut these ads. Oh, that's right. That was his super PAC with which he is not affiliated. I can't wait for this whole facade of campaign finance reform to be done away with. It's just embarrassing with the super PACs and all. All right. Let's get out of politics for a minute. I can't take it. Let's go now into the fun with more fun with magnets file. This is from MSNBC, believe it or not. Dateline Tehran, Iran. A bomb has killed Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan, a chemistry expert and director of the Natanz Uranium Enrichment Facility in central Iran. The bomb was a magnetic one, and the same one as the ones previously used for the assassination of other scientists in Iran, and is the work of the Israelis, allegedly. Now, the Fars news agency quoted Tehran's deputy governor. He said, quote, Iran's Atomic Energy Organization said the country's nuclear path would not change despite the killing, which we have branded a heinous act, unquote. That's the Persian, his name is Sarfarali Bartalu'u. That's what he says. He says that the country, Iran's nuclear path will not change, despite the fact that a couple of operatives rode up to this cat's car on a motorcycle and attached a magnetic bomb and blew him off the face of the planet. But nevertheless, Mr. Sarfarali Bartalu'u says that our path is irreversible. That's a direct quote. And I believe him. I mean, I think the Iranians mean it. I know that Barry Ho has come out and told us not to worry about Iran because they're such a small country. Now, where he got that, I can't even imagine. Obviously, this guy's making a lot of stuff up as he goes along. But they say their path is irreversible, and I believe them. Israeli military chief, according to MSNBC, an Israeli military chief was quoted as telling a parliamentary panel earlier this year, that 2012 will be a critical year for Iran, in part because of, quote, things that might happen to it, let's say, unnaturally. Like a magnet bomb. Man, that is so cool. I was sitting at a meeting earlier this week, and one of these Ron Paul supporters piped up, and he said, well, I want to know if the United States should be participating in political assassinations. And I think he was referencing this story because it was big news that day. And I said, well, if we weren't involved in this, I hope we took notes and we get involved because it's very, very good. And then I said, no more. I'm changing the subject. Anyway, back to MSNBC. A similar bomb explosion on January 12, 2010, killed a Tehran University professor, Masoud Ali Mahamahoumahadi, who is a senior physics professor. He was killed when a bombed-rigged motorcycle exploded near his car. So obviously, whoever's coming up with the bomb on the motorcycle, they're getting better and better. They didn't blow up the motorcycle this time. They only blew up the nuclear physicist, which is fairly impressive. Now, in November of 2010, a pair of back-to-back bomb attacks in different parts of the capital there in Tehran killed one nuclear scientist and unfortunately only wounded another. But, you know, maybe they'll get back to that. I certainly hope so. So, yeah, I don't want to devolve into a whole debate on political assassinations. Let me just say that if there is a country that is a sworn enemy and who is actively killing our forces on the ground, yes, they should be assassinated. And I guess we'll just leave it at that. And as of right now, I prefer the magnetic bomb off the motorcycle. It seems to be very effective. And very impressive. I hope they have a video of it. I mean, I would pay to download that one on YouTube. All right, now more from Iran. This is Dateline Tehran from the AP. An Iranian court has convicted an American man working for the CIA. Oh, they've convicted him of working for the CIA, and they've sentenced him to death. Now, this fella is a former U.S. Marine. His name is Amir Mirzae Hekmati. And he received special training and served at U.S. military bases in Iraq and Afghanistan before heading to Iran to visit his family back in Iran. Now, Iran alleges this was an intelligence mission, and I would probably agree with Iran that it was an intelligence mission. I mean, how many Marines who have special training go off to visit grandma in Tehran at the height of this nuclear tension? So I think they caught one of our spies. He's a 28-year-old former military translator, former Marine, and it sounds like he got caught by the Iranians. And I hope that our intelligence and military communities are working as hard as the Israelis are on their motorcycle magnet bombs. I hope we in America are working just as hard to release or kill those holding Amir Marzei Hekmati, because it sounds like he was a legitimate spy doing a job there in Tehran, and unfortunately was captured. We will continue to follow that story and see what happens. As we follow the rest of the Iranian story, I've got from Vienna, the Associated Press, diplomats have confirmed a report that Iran has begun uranium enrichment at an underground bunker. Centrifuges at the Fordo site near Iran's holy city of Qom. Are there any cities in Iran that are not holy? It's a holy city now, of Qom, spelled Q-O-M. These centrifuges are churning out uranium enriched to 20%. And I think I've got another story. I don't know if I pulled that down. Apparently, once you get uranium to 20%, if you've got the right centrifuges, which Iran probably has in their hardened bunkers, it only takes a few weeks to enrich to 90%, ladies and gentlemen, and that's when you have a bomb. I read a report earlier today that Iran has the capabilities. They have the 20% uranium. What do you think the odds are that they're going to try to enrich it to 90%? And John Bolton's of the opinion that they have enough of this for four bombs, and it could be a matter of weeks or months, not the 1 year that the Barry Ho administration is clinging to. Back to the AP article from Vienna. The facility in Iran is a hardened tunnel, and it's protected by air defense missile batteries and the Revolutionary Guard. Iran's nuclear chief, Fereidun Abbasi, is saying that, quote, the enemy doesn't have the ability to damage it, unquote. That he's saying that their bunkers are bomb-proof, basically, that we don't have the ability to damage it. And I would just remind Mr. Fereidun Abbasi of the Titanic. Remember they said that was... Remember the unsinkable ship? You've got the unbombable bunker? Well, I think we should take him up on that challenge. And one way or another, we should find out who's right. Okay? Because here's the thing, folks. Look at this. What happened down in Latin America this past week. This is from Reuters. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and Venezuela's Hugo Chavez lavished each other with praise at a meeting last week. Here's a quote from Ahmadinejad. He says, despite those arrogant people who do not wish us to be together, we will be united forever. It's almost like a death wish, isn't it? Isn't that like, isn't, what was the Shakespeare play where the two kids killed themselves? Do we remember the name of that play? I'm not really big on Shakespeare. It was like his most famous popular, Romeo and Juliet. So they're like Romeo and Juliet, and I hope we do unite them forever. In fact, I'd like to see them fuse together by great amounts of heat and light. Ahmadinejad was in Venezuela at the start of a tour intended to shore up support for the Iranian mullahs there in Latin America as Western economic sanctions begin to kick in and put some more pressure on the regime. Mahmoud and Hugo hugged and beamed and held hands and showered each other with praise and may have kissed. I mean, we don't have it on tape, but it's completely possible. Ahmadinejad also visited Nicaragua and Cuba and Ecuador this past week and is busy shoring up support among the tin pot dictators around the world that are, well, they're his peers.
We'll be right back.
Worldview, and I'm Doug McBurney, and we're rounding second and heading into the home stretch, ladies and gentlemen. So glad to have you with us this week on the Weekly Worldview, the most important conservative broadcast on the internet. And that's according to a survey of everyone here at the Weekly Worldview studios. All right. Now, more news from the war. I hate to bury you in news of the war. But it is what it is, ladies and gentlemen. This is important stuff. This is from the McClatchy News Service, Dateline Washington. A new top-secret U.S. intelligence assessment warns the Taliban leaders haven't abandoned their goal of reclaiming power and reimposing Islamic rule on Afghanistan. And according to McClatchy, this raises doubts about the success of the peace deal that the Obama administration is trying to broker between Kabul and the Taliban insurgents. Are you aware of this, ladies and gentlemen, that our State Department is in active negotiations with the Taliban? Shocking. Shocking naivete. The National Intelligence Estimate presented to Barack Obama last month also concluded that security gains won since last year's troop surge may be unsustainable. So do people get paid to write these reports? Because that's fairly obvious. I don't think you would need to be a high-level analyst with a PhD or a master's degree to figure out that what we've done in Afghanistan is unsustainable. But apparently they get paid to write these reports. And, well, here I am reading it to you. So there, I guess they earned their money this week. The National Intelligence Estimate came as the White House is examining ways to boost reconciliation with the Taliban, the U.S.-backed initiative to start peace talks. As an American troop withdrawal, actually they call it a drawdown, and a phased handover of security responsibilities to Afghan forces are completed by December of 2014. So all you Talibaners out there, you just hunker down until around Christmas 2014, and Barry Ho's going to drop a big Christmas present on you. It's going to be called Afghanistan, and you can roll back into Kabul and drop your burqas on all the women there and molest all the boys like Taliban leaders are known to do. Thank you, Barry Ho, and thank you, Hillary Clinton. And by the way, December 2014, if Mitt Romney is the Republican nominee, Barry Ho will still be in charge in December of 2014, ladies and gentlemen. That's my bold prediction. Obama, back to the McClatchy story, Obama has said repeatedly that the longest war in U.S. history can be settled only through negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban insurgents, not by force. Not by force. Oh, Barry, you're such a nice guy. Who would have thought that a thug politician from Chicago could convince the leftist minions, the Occupy types, that he's interested in negotiations and not force? I mean, how gullible are we people? Anyway, McClatchy reports that earlier this month, the Pakistani-based Taliban leadership agreed to open a political office in the Persian Gulf Kingdom of Qatar, raising hopes that peace talks might be possible. We could all be holding hands by Christmas of 2014 with the Taliban. Well, not you. Well, I mean, you could hold hands, but you'll be in a burqa, just so you know. All right. Let's see here. The Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton says that we're still in the preliminary stages of testing whether this peace process with the Taliban can be successful. U.S. Special Envoy Mark Grossman, is traveling to Afghanistan as we speak to pursue the peace initiative with the Taliban, who jumping Joe Biden has declared they're not our enemy. The administration is looking for confidence-building measures from the Taliban, such as renouncing violence and observing ceasefires in select areas in Afghanistan. That's just so nice. Boy, we're such a nice group. We're such a nice people. The White House, according to McClatchy, meanwhile, is still considering a Taliban demand for the release of five Afghan detainees from Gitmo. And U.S. officials say where this is headed is very uncertain. Yeah, well, there's something I agree with. By the way, this National Intelligence Estimate, this review, has renewed a debate between the White House, led by Vice President Joe Biden, and the Pentagon, and the State Department over the pace of the U.S. troop drawdown. Biden and other White House officials favor an accelerated drawdown. Yeah, an accelerated drawdown. You know, that might be the phrase that best describes the Barry Ho era. When you think about America in the Barry Ho era, think about it as an accelerated drawdown. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Barry's accelerated drawdown. I hope you enjoy the ride to the bottom. Me, personally, I'm getting off at some point, if that's possible. I mean, I'll do my best. All right, one more from the war. I'm sure you all saw the video of our fine U.S. Marines urinating on the bodies of the dead Taliban. And I don't know the whole story. I don't know what happened. All I saw was the video. I'm assuming there was a gunfight. And I'm assuming that that the Taliban, who had assumed room temperature there, had been shooting at those Marines. And the Marines won the gunfight. And I don't know, maybe they had to hold their water during the whole gunfight. And, well, you know. Anyway, Representative Alan West has spoken up. He is a congressman from Florida. He's a former Army Lieutenant Colonel who has seen combat. And he released a statement to the Weekly Standard this past week after he reviewed the video. And here's what Alan West says, and I agree with him. He says, quote, "The Marines were wrong. Give them the maximum punishment under field grade level Article 15, non-judicial punishment. Place a general staff officer letter of reprimand in their personnel file and have them in full dress uniform stand before their battalion and each personally apologize to God, country, and Corps, videotaped, and conclude by singing the full U.S. Marine Corps hymn without a teleprompter. As for everyone else, unless you've been shot at by the Taliban, shut your mouth. War is hell." Unquote. Alan West. All right. You know, the Taliban is our enemy. And they're not only our enemy in this particular war, they're the enemy of all civilization. Everything that is right and good, everything that could bring light into the world, the Taliban is the enemy of that. They must be ruthlessly and utterly destroyed. They must all be killed. There can be no negotiation with the Taliban. They must all be killed. And urination, I think, is, well... I think it should be considered on a case-by-case basis. Let me just put it that way. It should be optional. Just like, you know, burying them with pig guts. Things like that. All right. Now, God bless the United States Marine Corps, by the way. All right. From the culture file, let's move into some... Well, it's equally threatening news. Equally disturbing. But at least not as pressingly violent. This is from Haaretz News in Israel. Tel Aviv, the capital of Israel, has been officially proclaimed as the best gay travel destination of 2011. Now, that doesn't mean when you go there, you'll be happy and gay. No. It means it's the best place for, apparently, for homosexuals to go and defile one another. As a travel and vacation destination. New York scored top votes for best nightlife. San Francisco took best pride, whatever that means. Best pride? I guess that's mean they're willing to like walk down the street and just pronounce to God and everyone that they're deviant perverts and celebrate it. So San Francisco won that, no surprise there. Paris won best food. And Seattle got best settle-down city. I guess that's the best place to settle down and marry your deviant, perverted partner. I guess. Now listen to this. Buffalo, New York, was declared best up-and-coming homosexual city. I mean, that's just... Really? Let me tell you, folks, Buffalo has been kicked and down for so long. The last thing you want to see is the poor people in Buffalo look to something like this to try to boost the profile of their city. Best up-and-coming city, Buffalo? Come on. I don't know. Last time I was in Buffalo, you could still call a fag a fag. But maybe things are changing in Buffalo. That's sad to hear. According to this article from Haaretz, about 5,000 homosexual tourists were recorded as visiting Tel Aviv last June for their annual Deviant Pride Parade. That's a 25% increase over 2010. And now that it's been voted best homo city... Tel Aviv can probably expect even more foreign objects. Foreign visitors in the year to come. All right, just disgusting. Get that off my plate. Golly. All right. More from Israel from WorldNet Daily. This is from the politics file. Voters in South Carolina are being asked by hundreds of Orthodox rabbis to think long and hard about their decision and to, quote, vote morality instead of flash and dash politics or the economy. Yeah. We have Rabbi Yehuda Levin. He's a rabbi. He's a spokesman for the Rabbinical Alliance of America. And he says, no country, no empire has historically lasted past a certain stage when it has become corrupt morally. Yeah. By all measuring sticks, Governor Mitt Romney is not at all socially conservative. He is not biblically conservative, and I don't think his positions are in accordance with his own Mormon faith, as a matter of fact, said Mr. Levin. Further quoted, Mr. Levin said, therefore, our country is now facing a terrible, terrible situation where God forbid, if we continue this hurtling toward Gomorrah, this decline, it's just going to continue. We're appealing to evangelicals, Catholics, to put a primary issue, even before money, is morality and decency. We plead with you to spread this message. And please choose a candidate who has lived a pro-family life. Oy vey. Is it so hard to understand you people? Gemara, anybody familiar? The fall of Rome, please? Can anyone help me out here? Mr. Levin had to be escorted out off the stage. Anyway, he's obviously upset, and he's absolutely correct. I apologize for making fun of the New York Jewish accent, but I just couldn't resist. Who can resist that? Mr. Levin also said that, he said, capitalism alone cannot save America. No amount of financial tinkering can save a country which is morally bankrupt. That is what we learn from the decline and fall of other great empires of history. Thank you. Rabbi Levin, we appreciate your input. By the way, the group he represents is some 850 Orthodox Jewish rabbis in the U.S. and Canada. They serve 500,000 religious Jews, and they noted that it was compelled to, quote, condemn Mitt Romney's support and promotion of the immoral homosexual lifestyle and agenda, unquote. So, folks, let's take the gloves off this week from Rabbi Levin, all the way to the Baptists, all the way to the Assemblies of God, all the way to the Catholics, and all the way to the Mormons, for crying out loud. And let's all shout from the rooftops that Mitt Romney is simply no conservative. He's a liberal. Let's attack him for his liberalism. And let's please leave his capitalism aside. Besides, if any of you people believe that Mitt Romney had anything at all to do with any success Bain Capital had, then you're a naive fool. Because Romney was nothing more than a political frontman for Bain Capital. He gained entree to money for the folks at Bain Capital. Was he involved in the day-to-day operations of Bain Capital, or the decisions that made them money, the decisions that either helped or hurt companies that they were involved with? No, he did not. Mitt Romney is a phony, hollow frontman. That's all he's ever been. And that's why he shall never be the president of the United States of America. I didn't say he wouldn't win the Republican nomination. All I'm saying is he will never be the president of the United States. All right. Now, so on to some good news, some better news, ladies and gentlemen. I had my first meeting this past week with Personhood Colorado. We're putting together strategy for round 3 here in Colorado. Yes, I know. It's a Don Quixote type thing here in Colorado. We're tilting against the liberal windmill, but we simply can find no better way to evangelize the heathens, the pagans, the corrupt deviants who own and run this state than by putting this measure on the ballot in every possible election. Putting the truth in front of those who deny the truth, if you do it enough, eventually you'll win some. And so we're really excited to get started. Of course, we're being sued. I'm not a board member or anything over at Personhood Colorado, but I am a supporter. They're being sued by Planned Parenthood to keep the Personhood measure off the ballot. But good news out of Kansas, ladies and gentlemen. This is from ABC News. Proponents of the measure an abortion ban is going to be proposed in the Kansas House of Representatives. Proponents of the measure face resistance from some fellow abortion opponents. They should put alleged in there. Alleged abortion opponents. So people who say they're against abortion are going to work against the abortion ban that's being proposed in the Kansas House. Kansans for Life is the alleged pro-life group with perhaps the most influence in the state house. They worry that a push for an immediate ban on abortion will backfire on the pro-life movement. Can you imagine that? Now, they say they're pro-life, but they're worried that personhood could backfire. What I think is going on here is they're concerned that it will backfire on their devotion to keeping the money flowing to their phony pro-life industry organization, that they make a handsome living promoting the idea that we should regulate the murder of innocent people. And then they claim to be pro-life. Now, the Personhood Kansas Committee, which is the Wichita group advocating the measure, sees the measure as a potential challenge to legalized abortion, which I think that's what it's all about, right? If you're pro-life, don't you want to confront and initiate a conflict with the forces that have legalized the killing of innocent people? That, to me, that's what it's about. Let's get it on. I don't want to regulate it. I want to defeat it and stop it. And to me, that's pro-life. If you want to regulate killing innocent people, well, you just don't qualify as pro-life. I'm sorry. Go home. Shut up. Sit down. Get out. Now, the Personhood Kansas Committee says, quote, "We're at a point 40 years into this that there shouldn't be any confusion about what's inside the mother's womb. Maybe in 1973 we thought it was a blob of tissue." Well, come on, guys. Nobody thought in 1973 it was a blob of tissue. I mean, if you did, you were just naive and deluding yourselves. But anyway, I still good friends, the folks at the Personhood Kansas Committee. I never thought it was a blob of tissue, but I don't know. Maybe there's some dispassionate, inept, stupid, moronic liberals who believe that, but I doubt it. Anyway, ABC goes on to say, in Mississippi, now listen to how they put this, folks. I love this. In Mississippi, nearly 55% of the voters in the state's November general election rejected the personhood ballot measure there. Did you catch that? So nearly 55%. You know what that means, folks? That means over 45% of Mississippi voters voted yes, that a child in the womb is a person who should be protected by love and by law. So ABC, can couch this any way they like. But we almost won in Mississippi. And with the new language that we're going to put in, that we've put in here in Colorado, and with the new language that will be on the ballot in Mississippi in their next election cycle, we will win in Mississippi. Carrie Ann Rinker, state coordinator for the Kansas chapter of the National Organization for Women, says the proposed amendment is the most extreme measure abortion proponents could pursue this year. It's broad enough to ban common forms of birth control and even fertility treatments. Here we've got the pro-choice community admitting that some of their birth control methods kill people and admitting that their fertility treatments kill people as well. Now, when you can get the other side to admit what you've been trying to expose for decades, I would say that's a winning strategy. But the National Organization for Women's spokes skank goes on to say, legislators that sponsor and vote for personhood legislation should be prepared to stand with a class of very, very extreme religious zealots. These are zealots who stand in direct opposition to Kansas citizens' most basic elements of personal privacy and freedom. They're zealots. They're all crazy. They don't want to kill babies. They must be out of their minds.
Again.
I'm Doug McBurney. This is the Weekly Worldview. And we're rounding third and headed for home, ladies and gentlemen. And we've got some more good news from the Culture File. After all that depressing news about the war, it's good to have some good news. One, again, we want to give props to our brothers out at Personhood, Kansas. And that's not the only one, folks. It's all over the country. The Big Mo. The Big Mo is rolling. And Personhood continues. There's going to be a debate in South Carolina that focuses exclusively on this movement to end the legalized murder of innocent people. And four of the presidential Republican candidates will be attending. Mitt Romney has declined the invitation. But others will be there. This will be the first debate that focuses purely on so-called social issues. And I want to congratulate the folks out at Personhood USA who have done a remarkable job this year, this young year and late last year, of raising the profile of personhood on the national stage and declaring the truth of Jesus Christ to his glory. Praise the Lord. Awesome. You guys are doing a great job. Don't give up. Keep going, because we do win in the end. All right. Now, speaking of winning, let's go to Los Angeles, CBS Television, Ventura, California. A Ventura County Girl Scout is at the center of a national controversy after she released a video calling for a boycott of the Girl Scouts' popular cookies over what she calls a radical homosexual agenda within the upper ranks of the Girl Scouts of America. Now, this young girl, who has only been identified as 14-year-old Taylor, cited the recent decision by Girl Scout officials to allow a 7-year-old boy to join a Colorado-based troop last fall. Now, this boy, this is a 7-year-old boy whose parents dress him up like a girl and are raising him as a girl. Now, they should be arrested, and this child should be taken from them and given to someone sane within the family. Let me just get that out of the way right there. This is child abuse of the highest order. But now, not only is it being perpetrated by the parents against this innocent child, it's being encouraged, celebrated, and promoted by the Girl Scouts of America right here in the state of Colorado. And this Girl Scout in Ventura County just stood up and said, you know, no more. This is ridiculous. According to this Los Angeles CBS article, Taylor has linked proceeds from cookie sales to what she calls, quote, an effort to push a radical homosexual agenda at the expense of Girl Scouts' safety. And, I mean, it's just common sense that you can't let boys join the Girl Scouts. Isn't that common sense, or am I just too old-fashioned? I don't think it's right, okay? Now, this girl has apparently formed some sort of organization. Oh, yeah, here it is. HonestGirlScouts.com. You can go check out the story there. They say they want the Girl Scouts to eliminate sex education from Girl Scout permission and curricula. The group is also calling for the organization to cut ties with the World Association of Girl Guides and Girl Scouts, also known as WAGS, for its, quote, friendship, unquote, with Planned Parenthood, and its worldwide agenda of explicit sexual education for young children. A flyer on the website alleges that new CEO Ana Maria Chavez, they allege that she's a member of a pro-abortion feminist coalition, and suggested former CEO Kathy Cloninger never retracted her stated goal of partnering with Planned Parenthood to provide what she called good and information-based sex education. For Girl Scouts. I thought Girl Scouts was learning how to camp and sell cookies. When did they get into information-based sex education? Crying out loud. Now, Girl Scout officials, of course, have denied that cookie proceeds support any agenda, but instead help to fund local troop activity. You notice they didn't say that we're not involved in any of this pro-homosexual, child-molesting deviancy. They didn't say that. They just said we're not using the cookies to pay for it. Yeah, they want to protect cookie sales as they set their sights on molesting young children. Disgusting. The group should be banned. Their leadership should be arrested and put on trial and punished to the full extent of the law. All right. Let's go to Washington, D.C., if you want yet another signpost on the road to hell and damnation. A proposed bill in Washington, D.C. City Council would let homosexual couples who married in Washington get divorced, even if they no longer live in the district, provided they live somewhere that would not recognize their divorce. Under current law, one member of the divorcing couple has to live in Washington for 6 months before starting divorce proceedings. So, ladies and gentlemen, the heterosexual community has so thoroughly discredited the idea of marriage because of sexual immorality and adultery. That's us. We have so utterly discredited marriage as an ideal that now the homosexuals are trying to figure out how to get divorced. It's just embarrassing. I mean, culturally embarrassing. Washington, D.C., you'll remember. By the way, this is from CBS in Washington. Washington, D.C., you'll remember, began issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples back in March of 2010. Six states also allow for deviant, perverted, alleged marriage. But divorcing couples can face legal hurdles if they live in a state that does not recognize their union. I mean, this article makes my head spin. I'm confused as to what's what and who's who. I mean, who's marrying who and who's divorcing who? And if they don't recognize your union, well, you're getting divorced. Why do you care? You know what it is? It's because they want legitimacy. And I really think this is the difference between people who are going to hell and people who at least have a chance of going to heaven. And that is, if you sin, we all sin. But if you want your sin to be recognized as normal, and if you want your sin to be legalized, then you really have limited your opportunity to go to heaven. You're probably on your way to hell with jet rockets. If you sin and you're ashamed of your sin, then you have some chance at redemption. But if you want the world to stand up and celebrate your sin, and at some point make it legal, and maybe even at some point call it preferable, well, then you are going straight to hell on a greased pole. All right. Now, one more from the politics file. I'm running out of time. What am I going to do? What am I going to do here? I got, I'll get rid of that story because it's too disgusting. All right, I got three more stories. I might go just a tad long, but it won't be very long. If this is a part of your gym routine and you're looking for a straight-up hour, I apologize. I would encourage you to just stay on the treadmill. Okay, do a few more bench presses and hang with me. Here, from the politics file, this is from the Washington Times. A letter from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is warning employers that requiring a high school diploma from a job applicant might violate the Americans with Disabilities Act. I'm not making this up. In an informal discussion letter from the EEOC, the statement is made that an employer's requirement of a high school diploma, which has long been a standard criterion for screening potential employees, must be, quote, job-related for the position in question and consistent with business necessity. Now, I'm not sure what that means, but employers are a bit concerned. The Washington Times reports that employers could run afoul of the ADA if their requirement of a high school diploma screens out an individual who's unable to graduate because of a learning disability that meets the ADA's definition of a disability. Now, the commission's advice, which does not yet carry the force of law, is raising alarms among employment law professionals who say it could carry far-reaching implications for business. Yeah, like you're going to be forced to hire people who can't get the job done. How about that? Hey, and I'm not saying that everyone should have to have a high school diploma. Don't get me wrong. I think there are very successful people who never made it out of high school. And you certainly don't need a degree or a diploma of any kind. But employers should be allowed to require whatever they want to require, right? Isn't this a free country? Oh, I forgot. It's not anymore. Do I want to go on with this story? The policy could lead the EEOC to bring claims against employers or encourage applications who have failed to gain employment to raise the issue and sue employers. Unbelievable. So now not graduating high school is a disability? Please. All right. All right, more from the government education farms, the plantations. From Middletown, Connecticut, from CBS in New York. Parents in a Connecticut suburb are outraged over disturbing disciplinary actions at a local elementary school. They claim students are being locked in unsupervised scream rooms. I said scream rooms. Yeah. Disturbing allegations have surfaced of teachers locking students in closet-sized concrete scream rooms for punishment. Kid gets out of line. What does the teacher do? Take him out in the hall and give him a paddling? Sit him back in his desk and get on with the class? No. You got to lock him in a concrete box so they can scream. Now, teachers, allegedly, can hear kids in the scream room screaming at the top of their lungs. Other kids ask the teacher what's going on, and the teachers tell the other kids to just ignore it. I mean, is this Dachau or Bergen-Belsen, or is this a government school plantation, for crying out loud?
It's 80s, a horror movie.
Yeah, this sounds like a horror movie from 1986. Now, according to CBS there in New York, parents and their children have witnessed teachers placing unruly students in the tiny timeout rooms to calm down. One parent says, from what I heard, it's more traumatizing for the child than it was as a help. Kids were hitting their heads on the concrete wall. Kids were urinating in the room. A note to this parent, how about getting your kids out of this insane school? How could you possibly put your kid in a school where they might be locked in a concrete box? But what's a liberal to do? You can't spank them anymore. You can't punish them anymore. You can't discipline and train children anymore. You might harm their self-esteem. You might damage their future potential for self-actualization if you were to train, discipline, and maybe even corporally punish them from time to time. So what's the alternative? Let's lock them in a concrete box. According to CBS there in New York, two timeout rooms were implemented 2 years ago for special needs students. So these are the kids who are mentally handicapped. This sounds like Nazi Germany locking handicapped kids in concrete bunkers, for crying out loud. But CBS reports that there is growing community concern about their use. The school district drafted a new support plan to deal with students who act up. No information in this article as to what that strategy might be, indicating that the liberals are at the end of their rope. The only possible solution now is to kill the child, which we know that liberals already advocate. So perhaps that will be their... I mean, they're at the end of their rope as far as discipline. Maybe children who act up will have to be killed. I mean, I just can't imagine what else a liberal could do. What's the next logical step beyond the concrete bunker? A torture device. The New York State Office of Protection... I'm sorry, this is Connecticut. The Connecticut State Office of Protection and Advocacy for Persons with Disabilities and the State Child Advocate. How many patronage jobs you think are involved in those two organizations right there? Huh? How many dozens and dozens of inept nephews and cousins of governing officials occupy the Office of Protection and Advocacy for Persons with Disabilities and the State Child Advocate? Well, they're now investigating the school's use of timeout rooms. So they're going to investigate because they can't figure out on its face that this is outrageous and ridiculous. They need an investigation. All right. I do have one Tim Tebow story. Saved it till close to the end here, ladies and gentlemen. This is from CBS News 4 in Denver, Colorado. Denver Broncos quarterback Tim Tebow has seemingly made himself the poster boy for Christianity. Correction, News 4. He hasn't seemingly made himself the poster boy for Christianity. He is the poster boy for Christianity. And the posters are sold out, by the way. Because he prays on the field. They say he prays on the field after a win. Did you see that?
After a win?
Yeah. Anybody who watched the debacle yesterday realizes that Tim Tebow prays on the field whether he wins or loses, News 4. He was praying last night after being run over by the New England juggernaut that will win the Super Bowl. There's a group called American Atheists. They're based out of New Jersey. And they promote the separation of church and state. Actually, what they promote is the separation of spirit and God. That's what they want. They want to go to hell so bad they can taste it. They tell CBS Denver that the only reason Tebow is popular is because he constantly injects his Christianity among the public. So that should tell you Christians out there something. We outnumber them. We're the majority. The reason Tim Tebow became the most popular athlete in the country is because he's a Christian and because there's lots of us. So don't be cowed by these atheists and these perverts, okay? Keep your chin up, ladies and gentlemen, and keep your knuckles up and stay in the fight, because we can defeat these perverts and these atheists. Let's see. David Silverman, he's the president of American Atheists. He says he believes that Tebow is, quote, full of crap when he publicly displays his Christianity on the football field and said prayers are only, he says Tebow's prayers are only for publicity. He says, quote, it's not that Tim Tebow prays. It's that he waits for the cameras to be on him to do it. He's totally faking, says David Silverman, president of American Atheists. Obviously jealous that the cameras are on Tim Tebow. And who is this guy? I'm sorry, Mr. Silverman. I never heard of you. He's obviously jealous that wherever Tim Tebow goes, the world watches him. And Mr. Silverman has to issue the statement, Tim Tebow is full of crap, in order to get anyone to pay attention to him. He's like a fourth grader.
His name is like Charles Barkley.
Yeah, Charles Barkley. Talk about someone who's full of crap. Let's see. Silverman says that if Tebow is truly a Christian, he should pray in private. Yes. And then Mr. Silverman goes on to quote Matthew 6:5, in which Jesus says, when you pray, do not pray like the hypocrites in the street. He says, they pray to be seen praying, but pray in the closet. See, atheists love that verse. You know, they always tell you about that verse, but they'll leave out the verse when Daniel opened up the doors, when God's people were under persecution and couldn't speak out. Daniel opened his doors and prayed in public so the whole city could see him. And I put Tim Tebow in the classification of Daniel and not in the same classification as the Pharisees. But what would Mr. Silverman know? He's an ignorant, degenerate, atheist, pervert, scum with little to no influence. And I probably shouldn't have even given him any press here, but I just wanted to bring up the fact that he's a jealous, whining fourth grader. All right. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, we have shocking and disturbing news. I hope you're sitting down. This is from the Los Angeles Times. The Daily, which is some sort of website, I assume, reports that Paula Deen, long known for her fat-laden dishes such as deep-fried bacon-wrapped macaroni, deep-fried bacon-wrapped macaroni and cheese, I should say, is about to spill the refried beans about a medical condition that she has. That's right, you guessed it, type 2 diabetes. Paula Deen, who would have ever guessed it? The rumor is she's going to come out and announce that she is the victim and suffers from type 2 diabetes. Paula Deen, who did she have on her show? She had Jimmy Carter on her show. That was it. I was off the Paula Deen bandwagon. Not that I wouldn't try deep-fried bacon-wrapped macaroni and cheese. I would try that. Yeah, it does sound a little rich for me. But anyway, Paula Deen, who's had Jimmy Carter on her show, probably some kind of Democrat, she's going to announce that she has type 2 diabetes. And the Daily is also reporting, I hope you're sitting down, that the TV star has inked a deal with a pharmaceutical company to endorse a diabetes drug. That is so typical of liberals and leftists. Anyway, I guess that's all I've got, ladies and gentlemen. I will be on local Denver radio this week, maybe Monday, maybe Tuesday, where I will break down the Tim Tebow situation. All the questions and all the answers will be heard on KLT, on Bob Enyart Live, as I guest host or co-host. I'm not sure how it's all going to come down. But if you're a Broncos fan, you'll want to tune in. If you're a Tim Tebow fan, you'll want to tune in. By the way, I put Tim Tebow in my title. My listenership tripled. So I think I'm going to put him in every link, everywhere. That's it, folks. I want to thank my friends at KGOV.com, Denver Bible Church, Personhood USA, American Right to Life, TheologyOnline.com, and of course my other brother Daryl, who makes it all happen here in the Weekly Worldview Studios. I'll be back with you, should the Lord tarry, next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.